Hello, my name's Dave Emery. This is For the Record program number 227, and this is going to involve an examination of an LAPD corruption scandal that is rapidly spreading, and we're also going to take a look at some of the implications of this, or possible implications of this, for the O.J. Simpson case. This segment is excerpted from the One Step Beyond program of April 26th of the year 2000. An article, a story, I should say, that's been occupying a lot of space in the Los Angeles Times. It's been occupying some space in other newspapers, but not nearly as much in other papers as the LA Times, and not enough in that one, has been a huge and growing scandal involving the Los Angeles Police Department. We've spoken about the LAPD and institutionalized corruption coming from the direction of the intelligence community in RFA number 9 about the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, in RFA number 23 about, among other things, the criminal conspiracy section of the LAPD, and also in a number of miscellaneous, not miscellaneous archive shows, but For the Record segments dealing with the O.J. Simpson case. There are areas of overlap between these various things, including the fact that the person in charge of the crime scene on Bundy, at the scene of the murders of Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson, was a woman named Connie Dial, nay Connie Malazzo, who had worked for the LAPD intelligence unit that was basically the successor of the criminal conspiracy section. That was called the PDID, the Public Disorder and Intelligence Division. That was a unit which was involved in, among other things, the Western Gold spying scandal in the early 1980s, in which officers associated with, among other things, PDID and the security for the 1984 Summer Olympics were involved with collecting political intelligence on people in Los Angeles, not criminals, but people with whose politics they disagreed. They were conducting the spying in conjunction with a private intelligence outfit from the far right called Western Goals. They were taking this information and giving it to Western Goals to put in their computer banks and a matching computer bank in Germany. Connie Dial, nay Connie Malazzo, married John Dial, who was a member of the criminal conspiracy section involved with the series of events described by Lewis Tackwood in the Glass House tapes. Connie Dial then, according to Donald Freed, the co-author with Raymond Briggs of Killing Time, was the an individual who had infiltrated the L.A. left, had become a respected member of the L.A. left, and was viewed with great favor, and as one who'd done good work by the, quote, progressive, unquote, section in Los Angeles. It turned out that she was a spy for the LAPD's intelligence division. Among her previous resume credits was the Corriere della Sera in Italy, a CIA-sponsored newspaper. And again, Connie Dial, nay Connie Malazzo, was in charge of the crime scene at Bundy, one of a number of connections between the intelligence community or elements associated with the intelligence community and the O.J. Simpson case, and one of a number of intelligence connections running between the LAPD and the intelligence community. We're going to touch on the O.J. Simpson case later on in this program, but first I'm going to cover some of this enormous and incredibly important scandal that is engulfing the Los Angeles Police Department and which has enormous implications not only for Los Angeles, but beyond that for the rest of the United States, California in particular. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who gleaned this from the Los Angeles Times of Thursday, February 10th of the year 2000. This is an article by Scott Glover and Matt Late, spelled L-A-I-T. It again is from the L.A. Times of 2/10/2000. It's headlined, L.A. Police Group Often Broke Law, transcripts say, subtitled Probe. About 30 officers, including supervisors, celebrated their shootings and frame-ups of innocent people, according to informant statements. I would add, this should not come as all that much of a surprise. Not only does this kind of thing happen in other police departments, but none other than Mark Furman testified about this under oath while being investigated by the LAPD or examined by the LAPD in connection with an application for an early retirement. I would also note that the McKinney tapes entitled Men Against Women were broadcast on worldwide television, and Mark Furman was bragging about exactly this type of activity. We're going to come back to that later. About this growing LAPD scandal, which obviously reflects on the O.J. Simpson case, among other things, although there have been no connections made between the O.J. Simpson case and this investigation, with the exception, at least by the journalistic community, with the exception of Robert Scheer, we read as follows, again from the LA Times of 2/10/2000, page A1 by Scott Glover and Matt Late. Disgraced former officer-turned-informant Rafael Perez has told investigators that an organized criminal subculture thrived within the Los Angeles Police Department, where a secret fraternity of anti-gang officers and supervisors committed crimes and celebrated shootings by awarding plaques to officers who wounded or killed people. The more than 30 current and former Rampart Division crash officers who were in the loop, unquote, including at least three sergeants, conspired to put innocent people in jail and to cover up unjustified shootings and beatings, according to transcripts of Perez's interviews with LAPD detectives and Los Angeles County Deputy District Attorneys, copies of which have been obtained by the Times. The nearly 2,000 pages of transcripts, covering months of interviews with Perez, coupled with hundreds of other official investigative documents obtained by the Times, portray a police scandal far more serious than officials have previously disclosed. More than 70 LAPD officers are under investigation for either committing crimes or knowing about them and helping to cover them up, according to one document produced by members of a special task force probing the scandal. Perez has told police and prosecutors about a string of potentially unjustified police shootings, including one in which he witnessed an officer place a gun on a dying suspect and listened to a supervisor delay an ambulance so that the officers could concoct a story to justify their shooting of the unarmed 21-year-old man. In another, Perez describes his fellow crash officers as, quote, sneaking up, unquote, and opening fire, unquote, on two New Year's Eve revelers who were shooting guns into the air but posed no direct threat to the police. Perez said some officers specialized in certain kinds of misconduct. One sadistic officer liked, quote, to thump people, unquote, he told investigators. Another planted guns on suspects, while another, known as the Candy Man, liked to put rock cocaine on his unsuspecting victims. Sometimes, Perez alleged, officers orchestrated the deportation of undocumented immigrants who witnessed police abuses and could have testified on the victim's behalf. Quote, I'm going to make a very broad statement, and you're not going to like it, Perez told authorities 2 days after agreeing to a plea bargain on drug theft charges. Again quoting, I would say that 90% of the officers who work crash, and not just Rampart crash, falsify a lot of information. They put cases on people. It hurts me to say it, but there's a lot of crooked stuff going on in the LAPD, unquote. And skipping down, during about 50 hours of interviews with investigators, Perez paints a vivid picture of his personal journey from gung-ho rookie to corrupt cop. He talks about the first time he stole money from a suspect and his first foray into drug dealing. In that 1997 case, Perez said, he and his partner, Nino Durden, D-U-R-D-E-N, found a plastic bag containing a pound of powder cocaine on a suspect and seized it. Quote, we kept that. We didn't book it, Perez told Deputy District Attorney Richard Rosenthal, one of the task force prosecutors. Back at the station, the suspect's pager, which the officers had confiscated, went off. Perez called the number, pretending to be an associate of the dealer, a common police ploy in which officers set up the deal and then arrest the would-be buyer. In this case, the caller wanted a quarter of a pound of cocaine. Perez made the arrangements, and he and Durden hopped in their undercover black Thunderbird to go make the arrest. But according to Perez, quote, when we first got there, Durden said, screw it, let's just sell it to him, unquote, and I completely agreed. The partners kept the dealer's pager and did two more deals, netting about $10,000, Perez said. They hid the drugs in a green igloo cooler in the cot room at the Rampart station. What ensued, Perez said, was an orgy of corruption in which the partners seemingly broke the law as frequently as they enforced it. They didn't even trust one another, according to the testimony. When they were shaking down suspects, Perez was suspicious that Durden was keeping more than half the money. In other words, he was skimming off the top of what we were supposed to skim, unquote, Perez told investigators. Perez said Durden initially did not know that he was stealing kilos of cocaine from department evidence facilities, but that his partner was envious when he found out. I want in on it, Perez quoted Durden as saying. Hook me up, unquote. And skipping down, a note, this is the anti-gang section of, among other places, the 77th Precinct, and that this particular outfit dealt largely with the Latino community in Los Angeles. And once again, from 210-2000 LA Times, we read, gang members were stripped naked and dropped in rivals' territory. In one mass frame-up, Perez alleges, crash officers rousted a party and ordered several dozen gang members to their knees. He said that Officer Brian Hewitt, H-E-W-I-T-T, who has since been fired from the LAPD for a station house beating for which he may be criminally charged, marched back and forth, randomly pointing at gang members and instructing fellow officers which false charges each would face. After finding a gun on the ground, he told an officer to handcuff Rafael Zambrano, Z-A-M-B-R-A-N-O, to whom Hewitt allegedly said, "Little man, you're through. I'm going to violate your probation," unquote. Hewitt then allegedly turned to another gang member called Laughing Boy and said, quote, "You're lucky that I didn't see you before I saw Little Man. Otherwise, I'd be taking you to jail," unquote. These practices were accepted and protected by those LAPD officers and supervisors, quote, in the loop, unquote, Perez has told investigators. Protecting those secrets, Perez said, meant having a willingness, quote, to take it to the box, unquote. What's the meaning of take it to the box? Detective Michael Hohen, a corruption task force investigator, asked Perez during a September 17, 1999 interview. Quote, take it to the box is saying that I don't care if Officer Perez gets arrested, he will never get in front of a DA and in front of an internal affairs supervisor and say this guy did this and this guy did that, unquote, Perez said. Quote, and you know why he wouldn't do it? 'Cause he's been right there with us. He's done it all before. He's right there. You see what I'm saying? Perez asked, seemingly oblivious to the irony of his current situation. At Rampart Crash, that, by the way, that's capital, all in capital C-R-A-S-H, it's an acronym, beginning again, at Rampart Crash, where the motto was, we intimidate those who intimidate others, unquote, Perez said an officer learned very quickly that he is expected to fall in with the rest of his colleagues. In fact, even to join the unit, the other officers have to personally sponsor, unquote, or vote in a new member. Again, quoting, we have a round table and we discuss this person, Perez said. We talk to people who he's worked with and find out the type of person he is, unquote. Once in the unit, all eyes are on the newcomer as the rest of the group determines whether he is trustworthy enough to be, quote, in the loop, unquote. Women officers, Perez told investigators, generally could not be trusted. He referred to one partner as a weaker link, unquote, because she was female. Perez added that crash cops who were regarded by colleagues as solid or stand-up guys were not the ones who were by-the-book officers. Rather, they were officers who would be willing to perjure themselves, plant evidence, and fabricate probable causes for searches to put gang members and other presumed criminals in jail. Several Rampart sergeants condoned, even participated in the framing of innocent people, Perez told investigators. Before I arrived at Rampart Crash, I never put a gun on a person. Never, Perez told investigators. When you get to Rampart Crash, this is something that you're taught. This is how it goes, unquote. That sort of lawless policing produced big results for Rampart Crash. Officers brought suspects in by the carloads, Perez said. In one interview with Perez, LAPD Sergeant Luis Segura seemed incredulous that officers would be able to haul so many arrestees on trumped-up drug charges without supervisors scrutinizing their reports. Quote, I mean, it seems to me that red flags should be going off, Segura said to Perez. I know what you're saying, responded Perez, who lunched on pizzas during interview sessions. Again, quoting, all that was cared about was numbers. All they cared about was how much total narcotics was brought in, how much money, and how many bodies. That's all, really. That was the only concern, unquote. Even officer-involved shootings seem to receive relatively little scrutiny by the station's upper management. Some supervisors, Perez alleged, were even in on cover-ups. He said Rampart crash officers use a secret radio code that allows them to broadcast information about officer-involved shootings and other matters without alerting fellow patrol officers in the division and command officers. The clandestine code, Perez said, is particularly useful when a shooting needs to be, quote, fixed, unquote, to cover up an officer's improper actions. Here's how we were trained when I got to crash, Perez testified. If there's an officer-involved shooting, no one, but absolutely no one, not the lieutenant, not the captain, is allowed to come into the scene. You create some kind of diversion, something. Quote, sir, we still got suspects running. Stay here for a second. We've got officers searching, unquote. And what's really going on is they're discussing what's going on. Whoever's involved in the shooting, directly involved shooter-wise, will talk to the supervisor, and they will figure out everything. The game plan, unquote. And you're saying you learned this when you joined crash? Asked Rosenthal, the prosecutor. Quote, this I learned when I joined crash, Perez said. Again quoting, if we need to add something to the story to make it look a little better, that's what we do, Perez added, again quoting. If we need to correct something, then and there, before we have the officer-involved shooting team, lieutenants and captains and everybody showing up, we fix it and correct it right there. And we always say that once we come up with a story, that's the story. That's it. You never change it. That's it, no matter what, unquote. Perez said he helped cover up three unjustified shootings in 1996. The first was a New Year's Eve shooting in which officers fired at several unsuspecting revelers who were firing guns into the air at midnight. Perez said he helped collect the officers' expended shell casings so there was no evidence of the shooting, but had to put them back when officers discovered that they had two wounded men. A cover story was quickly conceived, he testified, in which officers would say the men were pointing their weapons at police when, in fact, they weren't. In the second cover-up, Perez said he witnessed officers place a gun next to a 21-year-old man whom they shot. As Juan Saldana, S-A-L-D-A-N-A, bled to death, officers intentionally delayed summoning an ambulance as they huddled with a supervisor to concoct a scenario that justified the shooting, Perez alleged. That supervisor was Sergeant Edward Ortiz, the man one LAPD official has said was, quote, quarterbacking, unquote, cover-ups in Rampart. Perez was one of the trigger men in the third and most widely known cover-up since the scandal broke. In that case, Perez alleged that he and Durden shot an unarmed man and planted a gun on him. They then perjured themselves to send Javier Francisco Ovando, O-V-A-N-D-O, to prison for 23 years. As a result of Perez's disclosures, Ovando was freed from prison in September. Such shootings did not trouble Rampart crash officers, Perez told investigators. In fact, he said they were celebrated. The officers gathered and drank beer and candidly talked about their misdeeds. They even handed out awards. Quote, the plaque that you probably saw in my house, you know what that plaque is even about? That crash plaque with a red heart and two bullets in it? Perez asked the investigators. Sergeant George Hoops, H-O-O-P-E-S, gave me that plaque for the Ovando shooting. That's what that is. We give plaques of playing cards out when you get involved in shootings. If the guy dies, the card is a black number two. If he stays alive, it's a red number two. Is it more prestigious to get one that is black than red? Asked Detective Mark Thompson. Quote, yeah, I mean, you know, the black one signifies that a guy died, unquote, Perez said. While Perez spoke in detail about the alleged crimes and misconduct of his fellow Rampart officers, he offered mostly anecdotal evidence of wrongdoing by officers outside the division. Perez said he and other cops would trade war stories at the shortstop bar on Sunset Boulevard or at, quote, the benches, unquote, at the police academy across from Dodger Stadium. Now, note some of the divisions involved in this. Quote, you know, 77th crash and Rampart crash get into a shooting. We talk about how things went down, how they really went down, and how they were fixed up, unquote, he testified. Note the 77th Precinct, the crash unit, and we're going to come back to that right now. This is from the Los Angeles Times of Friday, March 31st of the year 2000. This is another article by Scott Glover and Matt Late, L-A-I-T, of the L.A. Times. It's entitled, L.A.'s Police Corruption Probe Spreads. So note that the probe is now spreading to other precincts. Note which ones. The Los Angeles Police Department's corruption probe has spread beyond the boundaries of the gritty Rampart Division and now includes alleged crimes and misconduct in at least three other areas of the city, according to interviews and documents obtained by the Times. Internal police and district attorney's documents show for the first time that authorities are exploring allegations that crimes or misconduct occurred in the LAPD's Central, 77th, and Southeast divisions. As in Rampart, the allegations include officers planting drugs, making false arrests, and covering up at least one unjustified shooting. Note the reference there to a 77th Precinct crash. There's another reference to the 77th Precinct crash, and notice how one of the things Perez talks about here is how they shared anecdotes, basically they shared war stories, so to speak, with members of other crash units and people from other precincts. Recounting a short section from the 210-2000 article, while Perez spoke in detail about the alleged crimes and misconduct of his fellow Rampart officers, he offered mostly anecdotal evidence of wrongdoing by officers outside the division. Perez said he and other cops would trade war stories at the shortstop bar on Sunset Boulevard or at the benches, unquote, at the police academy across from Dodger Stadium. Quote, you know, 77th crash and Rampart crash get into a shooting. We talk about how things went down, how they really went down, and how they were fixed up, unquote. What we're going to do now is to take a look at some more of this swapping of war stories and yet another firsthand account by an officer who, by his own account, was involved in some of these war stories and involved in the beating and, by his own description, torture of several, quote, Hispanic, unquote, men who had allegedly been involved in a police shooting, at least allegedly at this point. And I want to note here that what we're going to be reading is what I'm going to be reading are some verbatim excerpt of verbatim transcripts from the Mark Furman tapes. Those were given to Laura McKinney, and these were broadcast. These were replayed in the trial and then rebroadcast on worldwide television, although not for the jury. This is from the book Legacy of Deception, subtitled An Investigation of Mark Furman and Racism in the LAPD, published in soft cover by Stephen Singular, S-I-N-G-U-L-A-R. It's published by Dove Books, copyright 1995, excuse me, ISBN number 0-7871-0863-4. And note the following excerpt of the Laura Hart McKinney tapes. This, again, verbatim transcript from the interview that she conducted with Mark Furman. Singular writes, on the tapes, Furman had said, quote, two of my buddies were shot and ambushed, policemen, both down when I arrived. I was first unit at the scene. Four suspects ran into a second-story apartment, and we kicked the door down, grabbed the girl, one of their girlfriends, by the hair, stuck a gun to her head, and used her as a barricade. Quote, we basically tortured them. There was four policemen, four guys. We broke them. Their faces were just mush. They had pictures of the walls with blood all the way up to the ceiling and finger marks of trying to crawl out of the room. You don't shoot a policeman. That's all there is to it, unquote. On August 18th, the Los Angeles Times reported that Furman's recollection of this encounter matched many of the details of a November 18th, 1978 incident in L.A.'s Boyle Heights neighborhood. By the way, August 18th would be 1995. Continuing. On that occasion, several Hispanic men were severely beaten following a police shooting. The officer's behavior had eventually led to a brutality suit against the police department. Note the following. On the tapes, Furman said he'd lied to the LAPD internal affairs investigator about his involvement in the beating. Quote, "They knew damn well I did it," he told McKinney, "but there was nothing they could do about it. Most of the guys worked 77th Street Division together. We were tight. I mean, we could have murdered people. We all knew what to say." And that, an excerpt of the One Step Beyond program of April 23rd of the year 2000. And that, in turn, from the book Legacy of Deception by Stephen Singular, copyright 1995 and softcover by Dove Books. And note that in that book, Stephen Singular was in touch with some of O.J.'s defense attorneys and came to question whether they were really out to clear O.J. or simply to get him off of the hook. I've speculated about the fact that, not about the fact, but I've speculated that some of O.J.'s attorneys may have been ringers. And in turn, the O.J. Simpson case has failed to come into public view with some exceptions in light of this particular LAPD scandal. The O.J. Simpson case, however, continues to make news. The Los Angeles Times of Saturday, February 26th of the year 2000, had the following story by Ann O'Neill. It's headlined, O.J. Simpson Files Suit for Brown's Phone Records, subtitled, Courts. The former athlete says GTE's data on calls can prove he didn't murder his ex-wife, Ann Ronald Goldman, in 1994. The article reads in part as follows. O.J. Simpson claims that records of phone calls between his ex-wife and her mother on the night Nicole Brown Simpson was murdered can clear him of having any role in the stabbing deaths of her and Ronald L. Goldman. Simpson is asking a judge in U.S. District Court in Los Angeles to order GTE Corporation to turn over the phone records of his former in-laws, Lou and Judith Brown. The suit was filed, Simpson said, after attempts to obtain copies of the phone records from the Los Angeles courts, prosecutors, and members of his own dream team of criminal defense lawyers failed. Skipping down, it has also been impossible to obtain the records from other sources, said Thomas Johnson, an investigator working on Simpson's appeal. Quote, Simpson has attempted to get them from the dream team, and they wouldn't give them to him. Wonder why, says Dave. Last word on this subject and in this program. L.A. Times of Tuesday, February 15th of the year 2000. This is an op-ed column by Robert Shear. It's headlined, O.J. Jury Knew the Score. And it reads in part, Now we understand why O.J. was acquitted. Now we know why a jury of his racial peers, drawn from a community with a long history of abuse at the hands of the Los Angeles Police Department, would take his word over the police and blithely accept that damning evidence of guilt could have been planted by the cops. Skipping down, At the time of the O.J. Simpson verdict, it seemed bizarre to many of us that a jury could conclude that officers of the law had conspired to frame an innocent man. If that trial were held today, the once-scorned arguments of Johnny Cochran would appear far more plausible. With nearly each new edition of the Times, there is further proof of a police department routinely wreaking mayhem on a minority community without the slightest adherence to the norms of the judicial process. Well, as I speculated about in the many programs I've done about O.J., I suspect that the white supremacist and Nazi element that was involved with framing O.J. also took advantage of exactly this kind of dynamic. One wonders also about what role the Dream Team played. That concludes For the Record Program 227. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.